Do you see that connection there? So, Adam becomes the father of other human beings who are in Adam's image, right? And the second thing that, well, and I'll just say this, and being in the image of Adam here, I think, doesn't just mean like biologically. I think it has to do with the fact that those other human beings, which he becomes the father of, sort of share in his being human in that entire condition and experience. And secondly, the second thing Adam does is that Adam dies. And that's important because as you look through this genealogy, at the end of the description of every single one of these descendants of Adam, it ends, and he died, and he died, and he died. With the notable exception of Enoch, which is the exception that kind of proves the rule here. Enoch is not only the exception to that, but the description of that kind of led to a lot of speculation about Enoch, which we won't deal with here. But what I think that sort of indicates in this sort of repetition that a person dies and he bears children. I mean, I'm sorry, a person is born, fathers children, and then he dies, is that death over and over again is kind of the hallmark of human experience. People are human, and what manifests that is the fact that they die. And so all humans, because they are in the image of Adam, because they are in his likeness and descend from him, have that same kind of experience of death. And that's really kind of the groundwork here. Adam is the human being from which all of our other human experiences, most notably death, come from. So in the class tonight, I want to talk about two things here. Because there are a number of ways in which the New Testament takes the figure of Adam and uses that to say something or other about the state of things under Christ. But I want to talk about two things specifically. So, the first is the way that the New Testament uses the language of image and likeness. We've already seen that here. That obviously comes from chapter 1 in God's first proclamation that he makes man in his own image. And then we just read it here at the beginning of chapter 5 as well, at the beginning of that genealogy. So I want to talk about the way that the New Testament uses this language of image and likeness. And I want to talk about it in a few different ways. Number one, man being in the image or the likeness of God, and what we can just sort of learn at a general level from that. We'll talk through a passage in James chapter 3. The New Testament then takes that language and ramps it up when we start talking about the relationship between Christ and God. We'll talk about Christ as the image of God, being in the form of God. It takes that same language, which has always applied to Adam, and takes it to another level when it starts using that same language to talk about Christ and God. And then there's sort of an interesting twist here that in a couple of places in Paul talks about human beings becoming in the image of Christ, and that being, in one way or another, the means to relationship with God and salvation. So that's going to be somewhat elusive. And what I mean by that is that there's a lot of ways in which the story of Adam and the story of the garden are brought up in the New Testament, and a lot of those are in subtle ways, right? Adam's name isn't all over the New Testament, but the story about Adam is all over the New Testament. And one of the ways that manifests itself is in this use of the language. We won't find Adam's name used in any of those texts that we look at there, but Adam is there because of the use of that language. I will say, again, this is the kind of thing that happens over and over and over again in the New Testament. You have these sort of small, subtle references to the story of the garden and the story of Adam throughout. This is one that is used repeatedly and heavily over and over again in the New Testament. But there are other cases in which that's not the case. Let me give you an example. My favorite of these, when Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb in John chapter 20, and discovers that it's empty. She is distraught. She's crying. And she begins, she sees Jesus in the garden, and she begins to have a conversation with him. But John tells us that she doesn't know that it's Jesus. What John tells us is that she thought that he was the gardener. Now, if you just think about that a little bit, I think there is sort of a small allusion there to the idea that, you know, Adam was the one who tended the garden in the beginning, at the beginning of creation. And here you have the resurrected Jesus as essentially the one who is the initiator of a new creation of God's people, as evidenced by the fact that he's raised from the dead. I don't know that all of that is specifically in that text, and perhaps I'm reading into that. But that's one of those little subtle things that you can find in the New Testament that really kind of tell us that, that Adam and the story of the garden, everything that we've seen so far, is always in the background of the New Testament. It's always there because this is obviously a foundational story and a foundational idea. So again, we'll talk about the language of image and likeness. The more explicit texts in the New Testament that deal with the connection between Adam and Christ are in Romans chapter 5 and in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Those deal with Adam as what Paul will say is a type of Christ. That is, he's sort of a pattern upon which Christ is sort of laid on top of. Those have to do in Romans chapter 5 with Adam being the originator of sin and death in the world. And then in 1 Corinthians 15, as the natural man who is subject to death. In Romans chapter 5, the counter to that is that Christ is the one who brings righteousness and eternal life. And in 1 Corinthians 15, Christ is the one who becomes a life-giving spirit, and that by his resurrection from the dead, so we too also will be raised from the dead as well. So that's kind of an overview. Hopefully we'll be able to get through all that. If not, well then, maybe the summary does just quite enough. All right, so let's talk about this language of image and likeness. Again, this is elusive. Adam isn't here in the text. These are lessons we can learn from the New Testament's usage of these words, which are just connected to Adam in the Old Testament. So the first place I want to go is in James chapter 3. If you want to turn over there, because this will be a class where we can kind of follow along into a number of passages. So again, not only is Adam not mentioned in this text, but the point that we're going to make out of this isn't even the point that James is trying to make here. This is a passage that has to do with how people should speak to each other. There's sort of an exhortation going on where James is telling us how we should speak and use our tongue. But in the middle of this, James makes reference to this idea of people being in the likeness of God to make a point about how we speak to one another. So, in verse 8, "No one can tame the tongue, a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing." So, he refers here to people who are made in the likeness of God. Who's this talking about? Any particular group of people? A specific set? Yeah, I think this is sort of a general statement about any person. And I think what's being suggested here, again, sort of in passing, is the idea that all people have some sense of dignity as creatures of God and deserve to be treated in a certain kind of way, spoken to in a certain kind of way. I think that not only serves for us as sort of a basic moral principle that it matters how we treat other people, but that it matters how we treat other people because we should be seeing other people as those who are made in the likeness of God. And so the point here is you can't praise God and curse God's creature at the same time. That's hypocritical. That goes against the nature of even who God is. So acting inconsistently that way is something that James is speaking against here. But again, the point here is that we've got the use of this language that supports this idea that human beings are made in the likeness of God and have some inherent worth, basic worth, because of that. So that's just sort of a basic moral point to sort of begin with. Let me then move on to discussion about Christ as the image of God. Because as I suggested earlier, what we've got here is this language really kind of elevates, right? This is going to be bigger and higher stuff that we're getting into. A couple of passages about this, and we won't take the time to read these in full. But in Colossians chapter 1 and in Philippians chapter 2, you have the statement that that He, Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. In Him all things in heaven and on earth were created. And in Philippians chapter 2, instead of using the word image, He uses the word form, which I think He uses somewhat synonymously. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who though He was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited. Do you see here how the language about image and form is different than that which was maybe used in James? First of all, it's a little bit of a different word. And this is something interesting that I found as I was kind of preparing for this. In the Old Testament, it says that Adam was made in the image and the likeness of God. And it's somewhat understood that those two terms are kind of synonymous with each other. But in the New Testament, it's almost as if those words have a little bit of a different meaning from each other. So Christ is never referred to in the New Testament that I can find. Maybe you can find it and call me out on it. But He's never referred to in the likeness of God. He's always in the image of God, or here in Philippians, in the form of God. It's almost as if the New Testament had some aversion to the idea of likeness. That probably has to do with maybe how those terms function differently in Hebrew and Greek. But sort of know that as a point. You've got this idea of a different set of language, a different set of words that express something a little bit higher than the idea of just human beings being made in God's likeness. Here you have an emphasis on Jesus as being like pre-existent with God, participating in creation, potentially equal to God. All of these have to do with sort of who Christ is in relationship to God, with Christ's identity, with His inherent connectedness in person to who God is, which can get pretty heavy. But just note that this is kind of what these two passages look at. So there's this idea that Christ being in the image of God is something bigger and higher than just human beings who are made in the likeness of God. This is Jesus who is actually with God and has an identity with God. But there's something else, too, that uses this idea of Christ as the image of God that I think is interesting. And that happens in a passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. It's actually in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and 4. So let me kind of give you some context for this. In 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and 4, Paul is making an argument that he and his companions are ministers of what he calls a new covenant, which is of the Spirit. And in making that claim, he takes the Old Testament story of Moses having to veil his face before the people, right? And he sort of makes an allegory out of that to say that that those who have received this Spirit through Paul's ministry that he talks about, those are able to essentially have that veil removed, and behind it what they see is the face of Christ in the gospel, right? So that's kind of the basic point that he makes here. So listen here to 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verses 3. We'll actually read through verse 6. Even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, The God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Sorry, let me read verse 4 again. Slow down and read it. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For we do not proclaim ourselves, we proclaim Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your slaves for Jesus' sake. For it is God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So hopefully you were able to pick up on that a little bit here. Those other passages in Colossians and in Philippians, again, dealt with things like preexistence or Christ's role in creation. What Paul is saying here is that in the face of Christ, we can actually have the knowledge of the glory of God. What this use of the idea of the image of God or Christ in the image of God tells us that those other ones didn't. What this emphasizes that those others didn't is that Christ is not only the one who is with God, but he is the one who reveals God and in fact embodies who God is. There's a couple of allusions to that in verse 6, right? They go all the way back to creation. This idea of light shining out of darkness, the one who gives knowledge. You might recognize those themes from Genesis chapter 1 and 2. I think this is another one of, you know, maybe, again, these are kind of the allusions that pop up here, referring all the way back to those original stories that surround the story of Adam. So, part of the point that Paul's making here is that when you lift that veil up, what you see is the face of Christ. And when you see the face of Christ, you see the very glory of God. You can know who God is by seeing Christ in the gospel that Paul preaches. And so that's a really powerful image, I think, that Christ as the image of God is not just one of another human being. He's not just one of another set of human beings, but he is the one who embodies God, who reveals God, and who is with God. So the last part of this little discussion here has to do with man himself actually being in the image of Christ. And this is the point at which the New Testament uses this language in reference to our own salvation and our own fellowship with God and Christ. This actually just goes back one chapter earlier. So I've already kind of explained what the context of chapter 3 is. But this language of image is there as well. This is in verse 18. It says, "And all of us with unveiled faces," that's all of us being those who are of the Spirit, in the Spirit, or those who are believers in the gospel of Christ. "All of us, with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, the Spirit." So, here in verse 18, Paul uses this image of a mirror, the metaphor of a mirror, to state that believers through the gospel, when they see the face of the Lord, they can actually become transformed into that image. The idea is you look in the mirror and you become what's in the mirror. And so you transform into that same image that you see. And by doing that, you then take on the image of Christ himself. And then if you sort of put that together, what's so fascinating about that is that you become in the image of the one who himself is the image of God. Putting that together, I think, is really powerful. And the other place in the New Testament that that discusses this language of becoming in the image of his son is in Romans chapter 8. This is a couple of texts. Some of what we're talking about tonight, by the way, overlaps with Philip's lesson on Sunday night, which was really kind of rooted in Calvinistic understandings of salvation. And we're not going to go totally down that road, but we're going to touch on some of the things that, that he talked about a little bit in that lesson too. That was kind of convenient that it kind of overlaps like that. So that will be good for us. This is one of the passages that he mentioned in that sermon on Sunday. And this, of course, is a very famous passage from Paul's letter to the Romans. In 2 Corinthians, Paul used the term transform. Here he uses the word conform, but they really, in essence, kind of mean the same thing in the sense that they lead to the same conclusion here. So starting in verse 28, we know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to His purpose. For those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, in order that He might be the firstborn among many brothers, or the firstborn in a large family. Which I think maybe more, if it's not an accurate translation, at least encapsulates part of the idea. Part of God's eternal purpose in predestining those whom He calls in the gospel is that they would then become into the image of His Son. They would conform themselves into the image of His Son, Christ. And so we've got another statement about the purpose of God to make Christ the root and the standard of approval before God. So I hope you can see in these last few passages that we've seen that what the New Testament does is it takes this concept that Adam is the one who is made in the image and the likeness of God, and when it applies that same language to Jesus, it means so much more when that language is applied to Jesus. It means more not only substantially. There's this greater idea about what the image of God actually is, but what that can show us about who God is and speak to the potential of who we can become too. If Adam represents who we are at a basic fundamental level, Christ represents who we can be and should be and will be. And so putting together kind of like all three of these ideas as we kind of walk through the texts that refer to this, what the New Testament is telling us, again, starting in James and ending in Romans here, is that first, all human beings have this kind of unalienable connection to God. And that gives them the right of dignity and fair behavior among each other. Again, I think there's a moral point to be made there. But that language gets heightened when talking about Christ, the one who represents not only the nature of God, but has the sole authority to reveal God in the world. And those who seek God and His will, God has determined that they should be conformed to the image of His Son in order for that relationship to be brought fully to bear. So there's a lot of passages there and a lot of talking. Are there any questions or comments about any of those passages? Anything that you found informative or insightful about that? All right, fair enough. So that goes from passages that talk mostly about... that don't talk specifically about Adam. Now we're going to get into a couple of passages that do here in the last... section of the class tonight. The first of those is in Romans chapter 5. And what Paul does in this passage is really interesting. There's a contrast made between Adam as the one through whom sin and death entered the world. And I think when he says that, in that first statement in verse 12, what that means, I think, is that sin existed. It became a thing with Adam. Adam almost, in a way, creates sin. I don't know that that's the proper way to say it, but it's something like that. He creates the category of sin. He makes it a thing that exists in the world, sin and death. But Christ is the one who is going to bring righteousness or justification and eternal life into the world. That's the contrast. Adam brings sin and death, but Christ is the one who brings righteousness and life. And to state the nature of the relationship look at the word in verse 14. Death exercised dominion from Adam to Moses, even those whose sin were not like the transgression of Adam. Adam, who is a type of the one who was to come. That word type refers to a thing or a person which in retrospect is a kind of pattern for something else that comes afterward. And so what Paul does both here in Romans chapter 5 and later in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 is, again, he's got Adam as sort of this baseline foundational figure for who human beings are, and he lays Christ on top of that in order to make a point about how much more Christ's actions mean for God's people. We've got this word type that Paul uses to describe that relationship. In that sense, the contrast is that where Adam, again, stands over this old creation, Christ is the one who stands over a new creation full of righteousness and life. The sin of Adam is going to introduce sin and death into the world, but Christ is going to undo the effect of that through his righteousness and obedience. So we've got just enough time maybe here to kind of understand the context of this passage. So let me try to run up through this really quickly. Sorry. This verse here. This is verses 12 through 14 of Romans chapter 5. Yeah, sorry. So, in Romans, Paul is trying to make sort of a large-scale argument about the righteousness of God. Remember in chapter 1 in verse 16, the gospel is the power of God to salvation, to all people, Jew and Greek. And then in verse 17 he says, for in it, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. And really what Romans does is it lays out the case that God's righteousness, God's faithfulness, is shown not in the giving of the law, but in the giving of his Son. And so, back in Romans chapter 3, you've got this statement. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been revealed, attested by the law and the prophets. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. Right? The righteousness of God is revealed through Christ, not through the law. And one of the ways that Paul is going to try to make that argument here in chapter 5 is to say that Christ, not the law, is the one who has the ability to undo the fabric of human error in sin and death. The law doesn't have the ability to do that. Christ does. You'll notice in verse 13 and 14, and then again at the end of this passage, there's these interjectory statements about what the law does or what the law can't do. That's part of the explanation of what Paul's trying to do here. That's not the focus of what we're trying to get out of it, but that gives you a context for what Paul's trying to accomplish here. What he's saying is that what was done through Adam, the law can't undo that, but Christ can through his obedience, through his righteousness. So, you've got this kind of reversal that takes place with Christ. And in verses 15 and 16 and 17 and 18 and 19, you've got all these statements about what Adam's sin does with a counter to what Christ's grace or righteousness does, right? So verse 15, the free gift is not like the trespass. For if many died through the one man's trespass, that is Adam, much more surely have the grace of God and the free gift of in the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for the many. Or in verse 18, just as one man's trespass led to condemnation for all, so one man's act of righteousness leads to justification and life for all. So that's kind of the nature of the contrast that's being laid out here throughout the chapter. So, like Philip touched on a little bit on Sunday, this text is often used to justify this idea of original sin. Philip talked about it in terms of the Calvinist doctrine of hereditary depravity, which is really just kind of one way of expressing this larger idea of original sin. I think sometimes people have tried to put those two together and say they're the same thing. Really, one is sort of a way of expressing the other. I kind of picture it that way. And so because of that, people have suggested that the idea of original sin is incorrect. I think I would clarify that by saying it's not a matter of whether or not it's correct or not. It's a matter of degrees. Like, in what sense do you believe in that? I think it's pretty clear from what Paul says here that there is an established connection between the sin of Adam and the sin of all human beings. It's just a matter of what is the nature of that connection. I don't think it would do well for us to say that that because Paul clearly, this is the point that Philip made on Sunday, because the text is clear that sin that death spreads to all because all have sinned, right? That last clause is one that makes it clear that this is that sin is attributable to all at a personal level. Because it says that there's therefore no connection between my sin and Adam, I don't think that would work, for the simple reason that if you do that, then you kind of cut the cord on the counter argument, which is to say that, well, then that may mean that Christ doesn't have anything to do with my righteousness either. And that's about 180 degrees from what Paul's saying here. I don't want to get too much into the nature of that connection, but just to say that it's pretty clear in this text there is an established connection between the sin and death that Adam brings and the sin of humanity and the death that comes as a result of that. I think, if I can sort of give a little bit of an explanation about how this might work, that when Adam sins, he again kind of creates this category of sin. Sin begins to exist. And what happens as a result of that is that what Adam sets is the precedent for the punishment of that sin, and that's death. And if you'll notice here throughout this passage, really the emphasis is over and over and over and over again on the punishment, right? So he's going to focus on things like death and condemnation and judgment. Those are the words that Paul uses most often. We don't get the idea that that Adam's sin or guilt becomes attributable to human beings individually. The closest you get to that is in verse 19. Just as by one man's disobedience the many were made sinners, so by the one man's obedience the many will be made righteous. You got the idea that by one man's disobedience many were made sinners. But again, I think that's really more of the idea that Adam in sinning kind of creates what sin is, and inasmuch as we inevitably fall into that, we then are made sinners. Again, the counter to this, of course, though, is that in the obedience of Christ, by which Paul means, I think here, the fact that Christ goes to the cross and dies and is raised from the dead, so we will be made righteous. Hopefully here the point of this is that you can see the way that Paul takes the story of Adam and sin and lays on top of that the righteousness that we have in Christ. Okay. There's a whole lot more that we could say about that, but we got to move forward. So the last passage that I wanted to look at tonight was in 1 Corinthians 15, and this is a little bit different. Although the point that he makes in chapter 15 and verse 20 is somewhat similar to the one that he made in Romans chapter 5, the outcome of the contrast here is not in sort of abstract concepts of sin and death, righteousness and life. The outcome of the contrast here is that Adam died. Christ will make you alive. Christ is the first fruits of those who have died. Since death came through a human being, the resurrection of the dead has also come to a human being. As all die in Adam, so all will be made alive in Christ. Here, Adam is the one who dies. Christ is the one who makes alive. This becomes more explicit later in the chapter. Let me just, again, for a little bit of context of what's going on here. The discussion that's going to take place starting in verse 44 goes back to a question that Paul asks in verse 35. How are the dead raised? With what kind of body do they come? Paul rhetorically asks, which is really a question that says, okay, Paul, what's the resurrection going to be like? What's it going to look like? And the way that Paul answers that is to not talk about the specifics, but to talk about the qualitative difference, the qualitative greatness of the resurrection to Adam as the one who is the natural man. Adam here in verse 45 here. So starting in verse 2, he talks about what is qualitatively better about the resurrection than sort of the original physical embodied being, right? So he talks about it's sown perishable, raised imperishable, sown in dishonor, raised in glory. Again, the counter there. And then in verse 44, if there is a physical body, there is also a spiritual body. That word physical there is a little bit misleading because this word really has more to do with the soul than the idea of physicality being inherently bad. That's not what Paul's saying. He's not saying that physicality is bad. He's making a contrast between that which was natural and that which is born of the Spirit. And so, in verse 45, he says, "Thus it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being, or a living soul. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. It is not the spiritual that is first, but the physical, but the natural, and then the spiritual." And so, the contrast here is in the nature of Adam's existence versus the nature of the resurrected existence, which Christ can give us because he is the first fruits of those who are raised from the dead. And that contrast goes on, talks about that Adam is the man of dust, he is from the earth, but what we will be in the resurrection is the man from heaven. We will be in the likeness of the man of heaven. In fact, here we actually pick up again on the language of image as well too. Here, the idea that we will look like what Christ looked like in the resurrection in some capacity. So that's the nature of the contrast in 1 Corinthians 15. Again, this is a statement where Paul is saying Adam was subject to the original existence of God's creation and that in the resurrection we will be like Christ. There are other passages that we could go to. In Philippians chapter 3 and 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, which express the same kind of ideas. So, this has been a really quick overview. I hope you guys got some of the issues here. But the figure of Adam is really important. I know we've talked a lot about Christ as the counter to that, and that is assuredly true. But I wanted you to see how much Adam is sort of fundamental to so much discussion in the New Testament. He really kind of defines who humanity is, the human experience, that humanity has worth, but that humanity is flawed, subject to sin and death in light of who Adam was. So hopefully you guys could see that as we walked through those tonight. Again, there are questions in the back for class on Sunday and Wednesday when we'll pick up back in Genesis chapter 5 and 6 with Noah and the flood. Thanks, everyone.